All right, good evening. We are on 76 Ayin Vav. Tonight's shiur is entitled Me, You, and Us. Me, You, and Us. I believe someone once told me, a famous rabbi, I don't know if he wants me to say it, say his name or not, that thinking up the titles is the hardest part of the shiur. So we're still in the middle of the kapitulach that in the chapters that were written by Asaph, that David chose to include in Tehillim. And last week, in last kapitel Ayin Hey, 75, Asaph spoke about the final days of Gullus before the coming of Mashiach. Here, he's going to speak about the war of Gog and Magog. The war of Gog and Magog is a war that is going to come and signify that Hashem is ready to return His Shekhinah in the open to the world. Now, there's a tradition from Avhaigon, who was, the Geonim were the leaders of Klal Yisrael during the time in between the Talmud and the Rishayim. So let's say in between like the years 500 and 1000 of the Common Era, Klal Yisrael was led by the Geonim. There were two Geonim that led Klal Yisrael at all times, and it was an official position. And one of the last Geonim was Rav Haigon, and he wrote that he had a tradition that Gog and Magog will come in Tishrei, at Sukkot's time, and because of the fact that the Gemara describes it as enveloping us like a tabernacle, so the Vilna Gaon designated in his Siddur that this kapitel would be recited on the first day of Sukkot. So anybody who came to the Shir on Sukkot, this will sound a little familiar, but we're going to look at a completely different aspect of the kapitel. As we've said, we have a new seating arrangement, so if you like it, fine. If not, let me know. We'll put it back to how it was before. The Vilna Gaon on Yontif designates in his Siddur a particular kapitel to be said for that day in place of the regular Shir Hayom. Our Ashkenazic, plain Ashkenazic minag is that when Yontif falls on a weekday, let's say a Tuesday, we say the same kapitel for that day as we would on a plain old Tuesday. So we say the kapitel that the Levim sang in the Beis HaMikdash in honor of Tuesday. We don't change it because that Tuesday happens to be a Yontif. However, the Vilna Gaon held that you should change it and say, instead of saying the kapitel for Tuesday, you should say the kapitel for whatever the Yontif is. And even though, and there are places, especially in Yerushalayim, that follow that minhag, but even those of us who do not follow that minhag can learn from what the Vilna Gaon picked to be the kapitel of that day, what he thought was appropriate for the day. So even though we don't necessarily say the kapitel, this is the one that Vilna Gaon felt was appropriate for Sukkot. Now, we've mentioned before the war of Gog and Magog, and we're not going to dwell on it right in the beginning here. The war of Gog and Magog, Chazal tell us, is something that will come right before the coming of Mashiach and the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. The details of the war of Gog and Magog, other than the fact that it's a horrible war, and that the leader's name is Gog, and the nation's name is Magog, that will come against us, the details are not very clear. The basic outline is that Gog and Magog will come, they will attempt to conquer the Jewish nation, and they either will conquer or it will look like they are about to win. Hashem will miraculously step in and save us, and under the leadership of Melech HaMashiach, and proceed from there. The war of Gog and Magog has very little details known to us other than what the Navi Yechezkel tells us, and even most of that is a little vague. We're not sure exactly of the details. And if you look throughout the various Rishonim, you will see that there are some who will tell you that the war of Gog and Magog comes right before Mashiach is crowned, or maybe right after, or maybe during. So it's a little bit unclear. But the war of Gog and Magog is a significant thing in Jewish philosophy. There could be said to be such a thing, that this war of Gog and Magog signifies that Hashem is ready to return His Shekhinah in the open presence of the world. Last week, Asaph talked about right before Gog and Magog, and now he's going to talk about that very end stage of Gog and Magog. And we're going to jump in here. In the beginning it says, Lamanatseach b'neginos mizmor la'asaf shir. For the conductor played on neginos, Mizmor la'asaf, it's a mizmor la'asaf, a shir. So this is both a mizmor and a shir. And it's played on neginos. So far we really don't know very much, because we don't know what neginos are. Mm-hmm. And we don't know, it's a mizmor and a shir. Mm-hmm. So why is it a mizmor and a shir? Asaf is trying to make up for a mistake that the Melech Chizkiyahu will make many years in the future. Chizkiyahu was the Melech of Yehuda, which had already become its own kingdom. The 10 tribes in the northern kingdom were already lost to us. And he was the Melech when Sanherib, the leader of Assyria, attacked the nation of Israel, or the nation of Yehuda. And Sanherib and his Assyrian army had plowed through the entire world, conquering nation after nation after nation. They had conquered the Plishti and the Cushites, everybody they had, and the capital of Assyria was in a place called Nineveh. After every single country was conquered, Sanherib decided that he had to march against Yerushalayim. He first sent his generals ahead to intimidate the people of Yerushalayim and to convince them that, you know what, why resist? We've conquered the whole rest of the world. Just lay down your arms and everything will be good. So King Chizkiyahu sent his representative to speak with them. And, of course, they refused to surrender. So Sanherib gave the order to march against Yerushalayim. Chizkiyahu HaMelech tore his garments and went to the base of Mikdash to daven. The prophet Yeshaya came to see the king and told him the following. Hashem has heard your prayer. Of Sanherib he has spoken the following. She despises you, she laughs at you at scorn, the daughter of Zion. The daughter of Yerushalayim shakes her head at thee. Whom have you blasphemed and whom have you scorned? Against the Holy One of Israel. He says that Sanherib has raged against Hashem and has made such a tumult that it has come to mine ears. I will put my hook into your nose and my bridle between your lips, and I will make you turn back on the way by which you came. You shall not come into the city, and you shall not shoot an arrow thereon. This is what Yeshaya Navi told Chizkiyahu. And he concludes by saying, I will shield this city to save it for my own sake and for the sake of David, my servant. That night, the army of Sanherib was camped outside the walls of Yerushalayim. Chizkiyahu and Yeshaya went into the base of Mikdash. They davened through the entire night. And in the middle of the night, a pillar of fire zoomed out of the top of the base of Mikdash and destroyed the entire army. In the morning, when they came out to see, every single soldier, except for Sanherib himself, was dead in his sleep. Sanherib went back to his capital, Nineveh, where he was killed by his own people. Now, we need to say what the Gemara says about this. Fascinating Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Tzadi Dalet says as following. Hashem wished to appoint Chizkiyahu as the Mashiach, and he wished to have Sanherib be the war of Gog and Magog. Whereupon the Midas Hadin came before Hashem and said, Hashem, if thou didst not make David the Mashiach, who uttered so many hymns and praises before thee, will thou appoint Chizkiyahu, who did not write even one hymn to thee, in spite of all the miracles which thou wrought for him? Therefore the issue was closed. Straight away the earth exclaimed, Sovereign of the universe, I will utter Shirim before thee instead of Chizkiyahu, for he is righteous, and make him the Mashiach. So the earth broke into song. The prince of the universe said to Hashem, Hashem, the earth has fulfilled thy desire on behalf of Chizkiyah. Make him the Mashiach. But a heavenly voice called out, It is my secret, it is my secret. To which the Navi responded, Woe is me, how long must we wait? Chizkiyahu HaMelech came within a hair's breadth of being the Mashiach. However, after this miraculous event with Sanherib, Chazal tell us that Hashem faulted him for not writing and composing tributes to Hashem in honor of the occasion. And because of that, he was not the Mashiach. And Sanherib was not considered to be the war of Gog and Magog. Asaf would like to compensate and would like to add shirim and mizmorim in honor of this event, that which Chizkiyahu did not do. So Asaf's purpose here in saying it's a mizmor l'Asaf shir, so mizmor and a shir, is he wants to compensate for what Chizkiyahu did not do, which is write tributes and psalms to Hashem when such a great thing happened. Had Chizkiyahu done that, it appears from the Gemara that Hashem was ready to make him the Mashiach. That's Asaf's goal here. And he says in the next verse, Noda b'Yehuda Elohim, God is known in Judah, but Yisrael gadol shemo, in Israel his name is great. When he says it's Noda, it's known or recognized in Yehuda, Chizkiyahu, when he learned that the Assyrian army was coming, made a rule that everybody in the entire country had to learn all day long, or they'd be considered a deserter and a traitor from the army of Hashem, and they would be put to death. Every man, woman, and child over the age of chinuch learned every minute. So Hashem's name was known, and it resulted in a generation of amazing knowledge, an amazing talmid chacham. And he says, also refers to the fact that Yehuda, your name will be known. So when David HaMelech became king, the first people to recognize him as king were his own people in Yehuda. And it was years later until the rest of the nation recognized him as king. So he's saying that Hashem is always known in Yehuda, because they recognized David HaMelech, and even the time later of Chizkiyahu, who made everybody learn in Yehuda. Vayehi b'shalem sukkah. And his sukkah, we're going to see what that is in a minute, called his tabernacle here, was in Shalem. Umanaso b'tzion. And his dwelling place was in Tzion. Now his sukkah is translated as dwelling place, that he dwells in Shalem. Now before the city was Yerushalayim, there were two places, Yeru and Shalem. Right? And only after David HaMelech conquered them and put them together did they become Yerushalayim. Which is a very, very long and interesting story in itself about the names and how Yerushalayim came to be. It's not quite as simple as we've made it out, but David HaMelech just came and captured it and thus gave it a new name. But for the sake of this evening, we're going to stick with that. And Shalem was the name of it before it was Yerushalayim, and that's where his tabernacle was, his dwelling. Now, the Sforno says that that's the translation of Sukkot is really his concealment. He says when it says that B'Shalem is his Sukkot, it means in Yerushalayim is his concealment. It's like a lion hiding and waiting. The enemy has no idea what they're about to deal with. Lions, the way they attack their prey is they hide behind some sort of bushes or concealment. And then when their prey walks by, they pounce on the prey. And lion, being the king and the strongest of beasts, the prey has no chance. Had no idea what happened to it. Just was walking by 1 minute, and the next minute, kaboom. So he says, you know what? That's how it is with people that start up with Klal Yisrael. They have no idea what they're dealing with. They're walking by, and they think they can just do what they please, and the next minute, poof, you wake up in the morning, and there's over 100,000 dead soldiers. They have no idea what you're dealing with. So that's what it means. Shalem is Sukkot. He's concealed in Shalem. And people think, oh, it's not such a big deal. They have no idea what they're dealing with. So this is important. Shama Shiva Rishpe Kashis. He broke the arrows of the bow there. Magen Vecher V'Melchama Sela. The shield and the sword and the war forever. The bows are referring to Assyria. Because Assyria marched across the entire world. They captured every nation. They met only minimal resistance. And the shield and the sword are in the war are referring to the fact that after the defeat of Gog and Magog, it'll be obvious that weapons are a futile thing. It'll be obvious that even though Gog and Magog came with every kind of weapon and every kind of possible device of war imaginable, Hashem defeated them easily. And the world will see that, you know what? Weapons really don't mean anything. One of the things that will be seen in that time is the whole world will recognize weapons are meaningless. Nor ata adir. If you're destructive and mightier than the mountains of prey. The mountains of prey is an idiom that refers to lions. So lions are always considered like a king of beasts. It's hard to... A lion usually almost always gets his prey. Then he says, "Is tolu abire lev, namusha nasam, velo matsu ko anche chayl yedehim." The stout-hearted become mad. They slumbered in their sleep, and none of the men of the army found their hands. And this is a reference to Sanherib. They slumbered in their sleep. They just kept sleeping and sleeping and sleeping, and none of the men of the army found their hands. Sanherib woke up and went out, and for all he could see, for miles and miles and miles, were dead soldiers. You are awesome, you are. And who can stand before you once you are angry? So Hashem is awesome even when he's angry. Because when he's angry, and he does things because he's angry to us, that punishment is meant to help us. When parents punish their children, many times the children at the moment don't really see the greatness of that. But when you look back on your childhood and you see, wow, it was a good thing that my father and my mother did. They were full of wrath at what you did, but that wrath was only meant to help you. So too says Asaph, that once you're angry, you're still awesome. Because your anger is so awesome, because your anger is only designed to help us. So even your anger makes us say how awesome you are. Not just when you do loving kind deeds that we see as loving kindness, but even when you're angry and you're full of wrath, you're still awesome because you're only doing it to help us. Mishamayim hishmata din. The din, the pronouncement, was heard from Shemayim. Eretz yaro v'shakata. The earth feared and became calm. Remember, Yeshaya Navi announced in advance that Sanherib would be defeated. Came in and he said, Hashem has told me that Sanherib will be defeated. The judgment was heard, the earth feared and became calm. Meaning that Chizkiyahu had betachon that once the Navi told him that Hashem had decided to conquer Sanherib, that it would be done. Bekumla mishpat Elokim. When Hashem rises for judgment, to save all of the humble of the earth forever. Humility, being humble, was a key trait of the Melech Hizkiyahu. Now we think of a Melech as being, there's a lot of trappings and a lot of whoop-de-doo, for lack of a better term. Hizkiyahu shunned most of that. He tried very hard to avoid all of the regal trappings of being a Melech. He ate simple meals, he tried to wear simple clothes. That all the humble, that in this was one of the things that Chizkiyahu had as a merit, that his humility, even though he was melech, which is a pretty considerable accomplishment, he still was a very humble individual, and he tried very hard to maintain that humility the whole time. A hair's breadth, this close to being Mashiach. Chichamas adam todecha, for man's anger will thank you, she'eris chaymos tachgor, prevent the residue of man. Of wrath. Man's anger will thank you. Even wicked people thank Hashem. If you remember the story of Nebuchadnezzar was ready to write praises to Hashem, and Chazal tell us that would have been better than David HaMelech's. But a malach came and slapped him and stopped him from writing these praises. Nebuchadnezzar was going to write praises greater than David HaMelech. So even wicked people praise Hashem. Hezekiah failed to do something that even the most wicked people in the world were capable of doing. Now it's interesting, we usually think, the Malach slapped him in order to stop him from saying the praises. An interesting way to understand it is, the difference between Nebuchadnezzar's praises and David HaMelech's praises is Nebuchadnezzar only could write praises to Hashem when things were going good. Whereas David HaMelech, as we see, wrote praises to Hashem in all kinds of circumstances. So the Malach came, not to silence him, but to see if he had a little awi, would he still write praises to Hashem? So he came and he gave him a slap. Right? He could have still talked, but his face hurt now. Well, now I can't write praises to Hashem, my face hurts. So it wasn't that he was physically stopping him, he was saying, give him a little tzaras, and right away the praises go away. La'avdil David HaMelech, who had more tzoras than it's even hard to imagine all the tzoras he had, I'd never stop praising Hashem. And he says, interesting, he says, She'aris chemos tachkor. The I wouldn't call it residue, I would call it the remnant of your wrath. When Hashem comes to save people, there are always people that are more worthy than others. There are people that maybe weren't quite up to the task. What he's saying here, Sharis Chemos Tafgor, the remnant of wrath, don't worry. Even the people that tried but couldn't quite make it, Hashem will bring along with everybody else. the remnants, I don't know why it says residue, I'll call it the remnants, you know, she'eris, like we say she'eris a plate though, from the war, the remnants, people left over, who maybe weren't quite as worthy, but who tried their best, Hashem will take those people with him too. Nidru v'shalmu la'Hashem alokeichem. So make vows and pay to Hashem, your God, Kol Sevivav, all those around him, Voshalu Shailam Mora, who will bring a gift to him who is to be feared, for Yivtzor Ruach Nigidim, who will cut down the spirit of princes, Noro Lamalke Oretz, and he will be feared by all the kings of the earth. So in these 13 Pesukim, Asaph is trying to make up for what Chizkiyahu did not do. The message in these 13 Pesukim is so simple as to be deceptively simple. The message in these 13 Pesukim is that Klal Yisrael succeeds or fails as a nation, not individually. Now, every Jew has to feel connected to every other Jew in order for Klal Yisrael to be a nation. It's like a waves of the ocean. One wave by itself may seem insignificant, but if you combine it into the whole ocean, it's very significant. Throughout history, now this can result in both obligations and benefits. Whenever Jews throughout history have allowed their own desires to become more important to them, tragedy ensued. You don't have to look very far back in history to find an example. I'm sure we all know Rabbi Weissmandel from World War II, who was extensively involved in Hatzalah work in Europe. And one of his big frustrations was that the Joint Distribution Committee and others did not wish to use money that could be used to build up then Palestine and to become a state of Israel to save Jewish lives in Europe. Many, many, many people in the Jewish world at the time put their own ideas and their own desires ahead of the Jewish nation. I would strongly suggest that everybody, if you want to see an example of how this happened, you should read Rabbi Weissmandel's books. They've all been translated into English. And he has in there copies of the letters he received back when he would write letters telling leaders of the Jewish nation, quote unquote, about the trains taking people to their death in Auschwitz. I will just read you one quote, and I think you will get the idea here. He wrote, "Those who go directly from the train to the gas chambers are suffocated and not branded. They are consumed in the ovens and leave no evidence behind. These are 95% of each transport. The dead bodies are burned in specially made ovens. Each oven burns 12 bodies an hour. In February, there were 36 ovens burning, and we have learned that more have been built." He goes on, and he says, "And you, our brothers in Palestine, how do you keep silent in the face of this great murder?" And he wants to know why they're not doing anything. I'll just give you one quote that I think will exemplify this. Yitzchak Greenbaum was one of the Zionist leaders of the time, and his response, which he repeated again after the war, was as follows. "When they asked me, 'Couldn't you give money out of the United Jewish Appeal Funds for the rescue of Jews in Europe?' I said no. And again I say no, and again I say no with all my heart. One should resist this wave to save lives because it pushes the Zionist activities to secondary importance." Menachem Bader of the Jewish Agency was asked, "Did you not receive the letter from Rabbi Weissmandel?" He answered, "Sure, we get letters like that every day, but we have more important issues." Now, these are not letters. These are letters from a rabbi who was standing in the middle of the Holocaust. He sent detailed maps of where Auschwitz was and how to bomb it. And this is the kind of responses he got. He got these kind of responses because the people who gave these responses forgot that Klal Yisrael, you cannot be one wave in an ocean. That the only way that the nation of Jews succeed is they either succeed or fail together as a nation. On Rosh Hashanah, there's such thing as a din klali. There's such thing as a din for the whole tzibur, the whole community. And that could be for good or that could be for bad. So let's say, for example, I personally am davening and I'm not so worthy of getting what I need, of getting parnasa, of getting a refuah. However, the community that I live in has done such exemplary work during the past year that Hashem decides to reward them by granting riches to everyone in the community, including me, who did not deserve it. The din klali, the din sibur, overrules an individual person's din. Unfortunately, sometimes you see the opposite. You see a tzaddik in the middle of a community, and the community is afflicted with poverty or with whatever, because Hashem has given them a din klali. This community is not worthy. There may be individuals within it who are worthy, but the din of the nation always overrides the din of the individual. When you forget that, it has tragic consequences. And what Asaf is saying here is exactly that. That the war of Gog and Magog is going to come, and Klal Yisrael is going to have to respond as a nation. Just as at all other times when we respond as a nation rather than individuals, we succeed, and when we respond as individuals, we don't succeed. Now, sometimes, that's all very theoretical. Sometimes a person can feel very small. Like you're one wave in the ocean. What is it one little wave in the ocean can do? Sometimes a person feels like their own efforts and their own abilities and their own successes or failures just are too small to make a difference. How is it possible that I can possibly, one little Jewish person, can possibly make an important difference? Does it really matter? So if you think of it like the ocean, then it really does matter. A small wave in the ocean really can't do very much. But the ocean is not anything except a bunch of small waves put together. When a person feels that they are a small part and can't really be accomplishing anything, what Asaf is telling them is to remember you're connected to something bigger. You may feel that you're small, but you're connected to an ocean of Jews. And all of those Jews and all of their waves put together are something that, as the Sevarno says, cannot be stopped. You don't know what you're dealing with. When all the Jews are together and feeling that they're part of that ocean, there's nothing that can stop them. This kapitel is meant not necessarily as Musar, that everyone should remember they're part of the great nation, although that is true, and that is certainly one thing that Asaf is saying. But his bigger point to keep in mind when saying this kapitel is that you are part of a better, bigger thing. You're part of something bigger and better than yourself. You don't have to feel down. You don't have to feel dejected. You don't have to feel that it's too difficult. You don't have to feel that how can I possibly accomplish this. You don't have to feel that, oh my gosh, what am I personally going to do, because you're connected to this ocean of Jews. And this ocean of Jews is strong enough the ocean can wipe out anything. And that's what he's trying to keep in mind, and that's what he thinks that Chizkiyahu should have written after the incident with Sancheirav. Chizkiyahu should have written this exact idea that you see the nation stood together, every man, woman, and child learned, and the enemy had no idea what they were up against. They went to sleep ready to conquer us, and for lack of a better phrase, they woke up dead. That's what Chizkiyahu should have written. There have been many, many times in Jewish history when we came close. There are those who say that had we had a different attitude and had not what I just read you been the priority of the Jewish community at large, that World War II would have been Gog and Magog. And we could have now been sitting in Eretz Yisrael enjoying the Shechina and the Beis HaMikdash. I have no idea whether that's accurate or not, for I'm not a Navi, and I'm not the son of a Navi, and I don't even know any Naviim. Nonetheless, we certainly see from Chizkiyahu's example that when the nation comes together and everybody remembers that, oh, what can I do? Oh, you know what? I'm part of the greater ocean. Then anything is possible. The people do not know what they are dealing with. And Chizkiyahu himself brought within a hair's breadth of the times of Mashiach. That attitude and that comfort and that knowledge that we're part of something bigger than ourselves that is unstoppable is something that we often lose sight of. We go about our daily lives and we're part of our, we do our own things, and we're part of our family, and maybe we're part of our shul, and maybe we're even part of our town and our community. But you have to remember, Baruch Hashem, I am part of an ocean of Jews that has Hashem at their back, and that is unstoppable. And that, just like the ocean waves, when they combine together, will carry people through, whereas one wave might not. That idea, that remembrance, that you're part of the entire community of Klal Yisrael, and as a nation we have a responsibility together, that will carry us all the way to the times of Mashiach. That's what Asaf is teaching us in this particular kapitel. Questions?
Well, what you said about the Holocaust, it took a long time, so things changed. A lot of people were killed.
Yes.
So...
Well, a lot of people were killed that did not have to be killed. I mean, I don't know what goes on in the Shemayim, but according to the ways of the world, if you will, did not have to be killed, especially towards the end of the war. There were a number of Nazi officials that were willing to, for payoffs, release Jews, either because they were greedy or because they were looking for favorable press in the West as the war turned against them, or some of them, you know, realized that they're in a lot of trouble and here's a way, whatever their personal motivations were. And it was very, very difficult. If you read Rabbi Weissmandl's book, it would be months and months just till they could find an intermediary to have a secret meeting with people. And it would come back with the details: for $50,000, we'll release X number of Jews. And what's interesting is that the time or two that they were able to get the money together, the Nazis always kept their word.
Really?
Right, one thing about the Nazis is they were meticulously detail-oriented. You know, everything had to be recorded properly, organized. You know, what kind of nation kills 6 million Jews and keeps records of their names? I mean, it doesn't... But everything had to be meticulously done. You know, when they took the money, they released the Jews. Now, sometimes their superiors were not too happy about that. But imagine being in the middle of the Holocaust, Rabbi Weissmandl was, and being told that the lives of those people in that town are not worth $50,000. Right? His frustration knew no bounds. After the war, there was a famous trial. I don't know the details in front of him, but it was a libel trial where someone had said something that, you know, Rabbi Weissmandl claims is not true. There was a huge court case over it. I believe it was in Britain. And that's when he brought all of these documents and he presented everything to the courts and to the world, and the court declared it an open and shut case that Rabbi Weissmandl, everything he had said was true. Now, that's fine. We don't necessarily put our trust in courts of the world. Right? But nonetheless, Rabbi Weissmandl has he put them in, and nobody paid the least bit of attention. Now, I say no, but it's not true. Right? But the larger established secular Jewish community paid no attention. And certainly the governments of the world paid no attention.
Was he living in England?
He was in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
There were others too. The title of his book, I think when they translate it, it's Mina Meitzar, is in Hebrew, and I don't know what they call it when they translate it into English. But in Hebrew it's called Mina Meitzar. And he wrote a couple of follow-up books also. And he has in there, you know, photocopies of all the letters that he sent and the letters he received back. And it's impossible to read. You get halfway through and you just can't read anymore. It's impossible to read. People forgot they were part of something. When you forget you're part of something and you're out for yourself, always has bad consequences. But being part of something bigger is also gives you chizuk. To know that it's not just you every day in this struggle, but that it's you along with millions of other people on a force that's unstoppable. So Asaf wants you to draw chizuk from that. And with that attitude, you're never going to come and say, oh, my needs are more important than the needs of Klal Yisrael. My needs are never more important than other people's lives, because you're part of something greater than yourself. That same chizuk, that same strength that you draw from being part of something greater than yourself also means you would never avoid that responsibility. If you really feel that you're part of something greater than yourself, you're willing to do all kinds of things to help people. The whole idea of chesed comes from that idea. Chesed is, well, I'm helping this person. I'm not helping other people. I'm helping my right arm and my left arm. You know, I don't get up in the morning and my left arm hurts and my right arm says, too bad for you. Okay, I'm feeling good today. I'm going out to the gym and I'm going to exercise. And you can just hang down there by your side. All right, that's too bad for you. It's ridiculous. All right, so you go and you massage your arm, and your other arm helps over here, you know, and maybe whatever, you know, body works together. But the same thing by Klal Yisrael. Chesed is just one arm helping the other. Right, you see people to whom chesed seems to almost come naturally, right, because they see themselves as part of a group. They see themselves as part of something bigger than an individual, and they draw strength from that. How is it? I've seen people that are involved with sick people, for example, in hospitals. And they're like, I don't know, 28 hours a day, it seems like. And you can't understand, how does this person have so much koach? Right? How does this person have so much strength to do all these things? And you're thinking, my gosh, I get out of bed in the morning, I do like 3 chassadim, and I'm ready for a nap. Right, these people, how do you see these people? You know the kind of people, I mean, they're just energy, energy, energy for chassadim. How is it they do it? It's because they don't see that they're helping other people. They see that they're just the right arm helping the left arm. And if your left arm hurts, you don't lay down to go to sleep because you keep pointing to your left arm to feel better. You massage it a little. Oh, you know what? I was up late last night. I had a toothache. I had this. I was taking some medicine. I was doing something for myself. So these people see doing something for themselves as everybody else in Klal Yisrael is just an extension of themselves. So just like they can't go to sleep because their left arm hurts, they can't go to sleep when they're sick people. That's what Asav means. The things that you're great. So they feel that. They feel that they're part of the ocean and they're a wave. They got to push all the other waves over there. That's the secret to drawing chizuk, Asav says, is if you're just you on your own, the going can seem tough. But if you know that you've got all the other waves behind you, and you're just one part of this whole great thing with an unstoppable HaKadosh Baruch Hu behind you, now you got something going. And with that attitude, he says things, you know, if people, many times throughout history, we jumped from Chizkiyahu all the way to the Holocaust, but we could go back through history and we could find many times throughout Jewish history, when people put themselves ahead, there's always disastrous results.
I spoke last week, okay? I have an update. I have an adopted daughter and a son. And I said to them, so what's happening? I understand it's really bad in Eretz Yisrael. She said, it's getting worse. So I said, what are you talking about? What they're doing now in Eretz Yisrael is they're taking their own community and they're taking a list of everybody that doesn't have food and they are sharing their food with them, okay?
What community is this?
It doesn't matter.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't matter. It's not what I'm talking about. Uh-huh. I'm talking about the poverty in Eretz Yisrael. And they said to me, it's getting worse, okay? And I have that information in my hand. And there are a lot of things that we can do. The kids could be, if everybody cared about Eretz Yisrael and not themselves, there's a lot of money here that could be going to Eretz Yisrael. And if we're not responsible for Eretz Yisrael and we're only responsible for ourselves, I am telling you, it's going to be worse. Just exactly what's happening here is happening here in Chicago all over because everybody is saying, oh, you know how many people are out of work? Do you know what the stock market is? Everything is going under. But in Eretz Yisrael, they're taking care of themselves because they know that they can't count on anybody but themselves. Why? Because the Holocaust, exactly what you said, is exactly what they know, that if they don't take care of themselves, nobody else is going to take care of them.
The halacha is that a poor people in a person's city, your own city, take priority, and after that, poor people in Yerushalayim take priority when a person is giving tzedakah. And I don't know, I'm just thinking this off, but I don't know if it's true or not, but it seems to me that there is a connection to this concept. Because why do we jump from poor people in our city to poor people in Yerushalayim? Let's go from poor people in our city, and then in our state, and then like in our this part of the country. Why we should geographically move around. Why do we jump right away from our city to Yerushalayim? Because we're all one big ocean, so to speak. It's like one big body, and it has parts. Right? The heart is Yerushalayim. A person's heart comes, you have a heart attack, you don't say, I'll go to the hospital as soon as I put a Band-Aid on this cut on my finger. Mm-hmm. You have to prioritize. So there's no question that it's not Yerushalayim. Any other questions?
I just have a question. Yes. Going back to
yes.
The Prophet Zion.
Yes.
No, but when it says on the none of the men of the army found their hands.
Yes.
Is that like they didn't find their weapons or they weren't? I'm not confused about that.
Good. I didn't actually speak about that. There is a medrash that says as follows, that they did not, that the men of the army, that none of the men of the army found their hands, that it is, in one sense, yes, it is a metaphor for weapons, but also there's a medrash that what happened is there were some nations that wanted to offer help to Klal Yisrael. The Assyrians were not all that popular. They just conquered the whole world. They didn't make a lot of friends in process. So they sent emissaries to the government of Israel to say, listen, how can we help you? We'll make a treaty. We'll do something. We'll smuggle some arms into you. We also would like to get rid of these Assyrian guys. I don't think they said Assyrian guys, but you get the idea. The Assyrians captured all the emissaries and they bound them up and they put their hands behind them. And when the men of the army find their hands, it means that they were free to be able to do as they wish. So when Sanherib's army was killed, these emissaries were able to be released and they once again found their hands. So finding their hands is an expression of success, of being able to get through this adversity, and none of the men of the army were able to find their hands. These emissaries that came got their hands back and got them untied, so to speak. However, none of the men of the army were able to say such.
The Assyrian army,
correct. So these emissaries, I don't know how many emissaries from other nations there were, let's say a handful, whatever, they were held prisoner by the Assyrians. And once all the Assyrian army was dead and Sanherib fled, so they could be freed and go about their business, whatever, and they, what was free was their hands. So the expression of finding your hands is an expression of freedom and success. They finally found their hands. They got their hands untied from behind them. However, none of the members of Sanherib's army were able to do that. None of them found their hands because they all didn't, none of them woke up.
Didn't they use this expression before in a couple of chapters beforehand, found their hands? Is it always like that when they say somewhere that their hands were tied and then they found, you know what I'm saying?
Sometimes. We had this once before.
That's the same idea that the hand
It is the same idea. And we actually had it before. The reason it sounds like so familiar that we had it a few weeks ago is we did have it a few weeks ago because we looked at this capitul when we talked about Sukkot.
Okay.
So we did have it, but it was actually the same capitul. And obviously tonight we're looking at it a little bit different angle. But since the Vilna Gaon designates this as the capitul for the first day of Sukkot, on Sukkot we had mentioned this capitul. So, wow, someone's paying attention to that. Any other questions? Yes.
It's hard to. Asaph was before. When was he in the timeline? Before.
So Asaph, yes. Asaph was a contemporary of David, according to many people.
Right. So I know that he had Nebuah and he saw in the future, but. Yeah.
So he was hoping that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would take his praises, and to, even though Chizkiyahu hadn't written any, he would take his in place and the Mashiach would be able to come. So he saw the Ruach HaKadosh that Chizkiyahu would have this lacking somehow of not writing proper praises to Hashem, and he wasn't exactly sure how, you know, what should we do to rectify that. So his idea was, I'll write Tehillim, right? And maybe Hashem will take that as, instead of Chizkiyahu's.
I have a disconnect. Why would, if he was well-meaning, why would Chizkiyahu be punished? I mean, for something that was, he was lacking in the...
So, you know, it's interesting. It's an interesting question. Why Chizkiyahu, who was such a tzaddik,
yeah,
and raised up Klal Yisrael to tremendous heights, every child, you know, do everything by... I mean, it was... And why not? One little thing.
It's not just the one little thing. It wasn't it's something that he thought of. It wasn't out of
right.
meanness. It wasn't.
So it wasn't out of meanness, no. And it wasn't out of any bad intentions whatsoever.
Yeah, so
his intentions were 100% good. So the idea is that, as Hashem is saying, in order to be the Mashiach, you have to be, obviously besides being a tzaddik, you have to be on a certain level. And you just missed that level, Chizkiyahu. So it's not that I'm going to punish you by making you un-Mashiach. It's that you had to, you have to score 100 on the Mashiach litmus test. You have to get all the things right. He had 99%, and Hashem said, okay, what's the last thing you need to do? And if he had written the Tehillim, that would have been his last, out of 100 questions, that would have been his last. So he got 99 questions right.
Is that right? Because perhaps the Jews weren't ready to have Mashiach?
I don't know.
It seems rather strange that the Jews would be punished because Hizkiyahu had a lacking. More likely that Hizkiyahu, this was nitpicked, so to speak, because the Jews.
Because it reflected something about that generation.
Yes.
I don't know. That makes sense. The Gemara that it talks about Hizkiyahu does not mention anything about the generations. But that particular Gemara is discussing, besides Hizkiyahu, other kings and various things that they did and didn't accomplish. Was his lacking of putting this final touch on, so to speak, because the people of that generation weren't really ready for it? I don't know. That's an interesting question. I don't have the answer. I'll see if I find anything on that, and if so, I'll get back to you on it. I don't know the answer.
Right, and if this was out, why didn't, like, Tehillim was out and about, I mean, it was written,
mm-hmm.
why didn't Hizkiyahu ever read it?
Yeah.
See, what's the meaning?
And why didn't he realize? I don't know. You have to understand that it wasn't that Hizkiyahu was happy and he went off to the bowling alley. Right? He sat all day and all night and davened and thanked Hashem and brought korbanos and worked on, he was doing everything he was thinking of in order to show Hashem how much they appreciated it. Now that thing, so David HaMelech wrote all these Tehillim already. I need to write another one? Maybe he thought, I can't write anything like David HaMelech. All right? Who am I to write? Maybe it was, we said he was a very, very humble fellow. And in fact, maybe he thought...
It was written already. Like,
that was right. So why couldn't he go here, and why couldn't he see that it's talking about it, right?
But Hashem gives talent to the people.
Mm-hmm.
So if David HaMel had a way with words, but Hizkiyahu had a way with his actions,
right?
too.
So it could very well be that Hizkiyahu, who was a very, very humble fellow, looked at Tehillim and said, who am I to try and write something like that? Right? I'm going to go. I'm going to get everybody to learn. I'm going to whip up everybody in the country to do what they're supposed to, and that's good because I got this whole army to make them do it here. But who am I to write like David HaMelech? Maybe. And you know what? We've seen before that sometimes whether it's humility or compassion, and what defines a tzaddik is the ability to apply the proper mida at the proper time. Perhaps, and again, this is just, we're just speculating here. I have no knowledge. No Navi has come and spoken to me recently. Perhaps Hizkiyahu's own humility should not, maybe he applied at the wrong time. He said, I can't write things like David HaMelech. And Hashem said, you know what? You should have tried. It's like, you don't get to not try because you can't do things. There's no way that I can give as much tzedakah tomorrow as the Rechmas. It's not going to happen. So therefore, I don't have to give any tzedakah, right? What are my efforts going to be? So just because you can't accomplish a high goal does not mean you don't try. So it could be that Hizkiyahu should have tried. And whether his writing would have been as good as David HaMelech or not doesn't seem to even be the point. The point is that it was in his complete Mashiach Tzidkus, whatever that is, there was 1%, he didn't express himself in that way as Mashiach should have. And it's even hard to say because, when you have something like a Hizkiyahu who's a 99% tzaddik, we could spend the rest of our lives going over all the great things he did. And it really doesn't seem fair to focus, we're focusing on the one question at the end of the 100 that he got wrong instead of the 99 that he got right. So the 99 he got right put him, David HaMelech wasn't Mashiach either. Yes?
I might have missed it, but how do we know that it's about Hizkiyahu? It doesn't say anywhere, maybe nobody knew it.
Chazal, we have a tradition. Chazal tell us we have a tradition that that's what it's referring to. And you see throughout the verses that there are a number of things that are sort of descriptive, the slumbering in their sleeps, etc., of the whole situation that happened with Sanherib and the Assyrian army. There were other times in Klal Yisrael's history, and we're not going to probably go into that tonight, where Chazal tell us that the coming of Mashiach was a close but no cigar kind of thing. And it seems to be that the bar is pretty high. Hizkiyahu, if you study the life of Hizkiyahu, it's hard to find anything he did wrong. I mean, the man was such a humble, perfect servant of Klal Yisrael and servant of Hashem that it was like he was hearkening back almost to the days of David HaMelech. Yet, he didn't make that final cut. It seems like, Chazal tell us, Mashiach will come either when we do something that's worthy of Mashiach coming, or barring that, at whatever the appointed time is. So it's an appointed time. If you guys really, really, really don't make it till then Mashiach comes, no matter what. The world only is going to last a certain amount of time. However, you have the power, Chizkiyahu had the power to become Mashiach then, and shave thousands of years off of it. So we do have the ability to have a Mashiach that develops into a Mashiach, and maybe he will and maybe he won't.
Well, there's something very unusual about the situation because all the soldiers were found dead in the morning.
And you see,
so,
he was given the gift. And Hashem, you know, and you see the strong language Hashem used against the Assyrians, all right? That they have, you know, how they have bucked him, and this is it, they are going to be wiped out. Right? And those are all the things that Chazal tell us look like Gog and Magog kind of war. Right? I mean, it looked like everything was over. You got all these hundreds of thousands of soldiers. Nobody, no analyst on CNN would have given the Jews half a chance. Right? It would have been easy, it would have been obviously easy wipeout. No, nobody would have given us half a chance. Then the next morning they're all dead and their king is fleeing.
It happened in the Six-Day War.
So
right?
There's many examples of this. You see all kinds of things, and if you look throughout, even if you look in the Holocaust, you know, if you read the Holocaust literature, if you can read it, you can stomach to read it, right, there are all kinds of miracles that happened throughout there. Right? There is no question. You know, on Wednesday night we're learning Megillas Esther. And the entire nation of Klal Yisrael did teshuva and were saved from these horrible decrees. So I recall once a young sort of chutzpahdik fellow, whose name I will not mention, but whom most of you are currently listening to, asking his Rebbe when he was a young fellow, "So Rebbe, if during the Holocaust all of Klal Yisrael had done teshuva, would we have been saved?" And the Rebbe said, 100%. So even without that, and you say, oh my gosh, there are only 600,000 people survived. Every one of those 600,000 people that survived has a story they tell of how they miraculously survived. Hashem made a promise. The Jews aren't going to be wiped out. So 600,000 of them were saved. Each one with their own miraculous story. Had the entire nation of Klal Yisrael fallen to their knees in teshuva and daven to Hashem day and night, every single one of the millions of Jews of the world, we wouldn't be having this discussion now. And you know that we can use the Holocaust as an example because it's so close in time to us. You can go back through history and you can find that many times. Right? That the enemy comes, and our response is sort of there, but it's not all the way there. Some people davened teshuva, and some people didn't, and whatever, whatever, whatever. You can go back through history and it's always been like that since the times of Shushan. Shushan was the last time that Klal Yisrael en masse, as an entire body, came together like that. Which you can learn about on Wednesday at 8 o'clock. Any other questions?
Number 2 didn't come out though yet, did it?
It did. It's on the website.
When did it do that?
I got a notice.
I think
about
Thursday.
Thursday or Friday.
Thursday or Friday.
The place that you